any policing that happens, which means the ability to hire or fire policing, to discipline police in our communities. We've called for community cop watches, where we watch the police safety walks, where we create other avenues of safety which are not around the police. So we are continually to supporting the organizers and activists who were arrested. We are gathering bail funds as we speak. We're getting lawyers for these folks. Again, another bail hearing is scheduled for the 27th. So right now, we need as much solidarity and support as possible to support these folks and to continue to fight against Cop City being built.
Activist attorney Kamau Franklin is founder of the organization Community Movement Builders, speaking to us from Atlanta, Georgia. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
In hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you're a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse, and that's how it's done. War after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket.
And good morning, everybody. This is KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Rowland, be with you for the hour. And before I introduce my guest, Chris Hedges, I just want to remind you that we are in our end-of-the-year membership drive, and I want to thank a few people who have donated: Miriam, John, Russell, John, and James in the past few hours, and you can join them by going to our website, kboo.fm/give, or just go to the homepage, click on donate. You can also text KBOO to 44321. We appreciate that very much. We'll be talking about that a little more. And we will be talking about the war racket once again with my guest, Chris Hedges, who is a writer and an essayist and the author of 14 books. And he had been a war correspondent for 2 decades in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, including 15 years with the New York Times, where he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize, but they didn't end up appreciating him for speaking out outside the confines of the New York Times against war. And he started out his book writing career by writing 2 books, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and What Every Person Should Know About War. And he is back on that theme with his latest book, The Greatest Evil is War. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
And a good solstice to you. This is the 21st, the longest night of the year, although it is day right now. So it's really great to have you back on. You've been, we've had you on a number of times here on Wednesday Talk Radio, often during membership drive. We really appreciate your being on our airwaves and your supporting our station. Maybe you could just start out by reading a first section that you had prepared, talking about your own personal experience with war?
Sure. This is from the beginning of the book. I know the chaos and disorientation of war, the constant uncertainty and confusion. In a firefight, you are only aware of what is happening a few feet around you. You desperately and not always successfully struggle to figure out where the firing is coming from to avoid being hit. I have felt the helplessness and paralyzing fear, which years later descend on me like a freight train in the middle of the night, leaving me wrapped in coils of terror, my heart racing, my body dripping with sweat. I have heard the wails of those convulsed by grief as they clutch the bodies of friends and family, including children. I hear them still. It does not matter the language, Spanish, Arabic, Hebrew, Dinka, Serbo-Croatian, Albanian, Ukrainian, Russian. Death cuts through the linguistic barriers. I know what wounds look like, legs blown off, heads imploded into a bloody, pulpy mass, gaping holes in stomachs, pools of blood, cries of the dying, sometimes for their mothers, and the smell of death, the supreme sacrifice made for flies and maggots. I was beaten by Iraqi and Saudi secret police. I was taken prisoner by the Contras in Nicaragua, who radioed back to their base in Honduras to see if they should kill me, and again in Basra after the first Gulf War in Iraq, never knowing if I would be executed, under constant guard, and often without food, drinking out of mud puddles. The primary lesson in war is that we, as distinct individuals, do not matter. We become numbers, fodder, objects. Life, once precious and sacred, becomes meaningless, sacrificed to the insatiable appetite of Mars.
That's a really powerful description. I know that you talk about in your book, further on in your book, the in a sense the fundamental indescribability of war as an experience to really be able to transmit to someone who hasn't actually, you know, we can hear those words, we can sort of, maybe people have had experiences that in some way touches upon that experience, but the as you call it, I guess, the hallucinogenic quality, just the total encompassing atmosphere of war is impossible to translate. And I think maybe we can just go off on there and talk about, is that, do you think that's part of why, war continues, why it's so easy for people to justify war, to be boosters for war, because they really, we really don't look at it. We don't, it's really hard to, it's hard to put ourselves in that situation. And I think we really don't want to look at it.
It's that, but it's also the mythologizing of war by the media, by the entertainment industry, by the state. And it's very hard to counter that narrative. Veterans that come back from war, any war, and seek to speak about the reality of war, the truth about war, run precisely into that vast narrative, official narrative of glory and honor and patriotism, and it oftentimes is extremely difficult for them emotionally to impart that reality in the face of that vast mythology. There's also the fact that people don't really want to grasp the reality of war, because the celebration of war is really a celebration of us. We see it with the Ukraine, of our virtues and our probity and our kind of that moral crusade that the state always attempts to sell us to justify war. We saw it at the beginning of the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, where we would liberate the Iraqi people and liberate the women of Afghanistan. So it's those, I think, two factors. I think ultimately the reality of war is not cannot be conveyed. I mean, for instance, you see images of war, but they are devoid of that fundamental emotion of fear, even terror, that grips you in the midst of combat, not to mention the smells and the sounds. And like many people who've been in a lot of combat, my hearing is kind of gone. Landscapes can be literally hallucinogenic. I mean, I look back on my 20 years as a war correspondent, and sometimes I wonder, did I really see that when shells, for instance, I was in Sarajevo during the war, when shells come in, especially the heavy shells that the Serbs were lobbying into the besieged city, these were 155 howitzers or the Soviet equivalent to 90-millimeter tank rounds, Katyusha rockets, which are fired in bursts of 12 or 24, and you hear them whooshing through the sky, and they hit an apartment, four or five-story apartment building, doesn't exist anymore once they're hit, with all of the victims inside. So those heavy artillery pieces do to human bodies is never transmitted to a public. It's just so horrifying. As disturbing as the images were from Sarajevo, no one ever saw a fraction of what we saw over there. I think the only people who actually see war are the people who go to war.
And of course, it's almost become a truism that, you know, even the images that were broadcast, like say during the Vietnam War, which, you know, ended up becoming a big reason why there was so much opposition developed to the war in Vietnam, that was shown night after night on TV. But even there, it was sanitized. I mean, there were a lot of brutal images shown, which did have a real impact. And people, obviously, in the war, the runners of the war racket, as Buffy Marie sings about, learned the lesson, and so it's even more sanitized now, right?
Well, that's what happened with the first Gulf War. The press, there was this myth within the military that the press lost the war in Vietnam. I mean, we look back at the beginning of the war, the press signed on for the cause, and it was only as the war progressed, and especially as middle-class families began to lose their kids to the war, that people began to ask questions, and the press was freed from imparting this mythical narrative to writing, you know, a sensory narrative, i.e. what it is they saw and witnessed, rather than fitting it into the package that the public and the press and of course the government wanted. But at the inception of the war in Vietnam, they did that. And in the first Gulf War, which I covered for the New York Times, the press restrictions were very, very heavy. They were pools. You could only go out with an escort. You saw what they wanted you to see. Reporters and photographers were embedded in units. This was also true in the second Gulf War with the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, and you get a very skewed perception of what's actually happening. I never embedded, by the way. I speak Arabic. I'd spent 7 years in the Middle East, so I filed reports for the New York Times outside of the pool system, which drove the military. Dick Cheney was the Secretary of Defense, drew up a list of 14 reporters he wanted expelled from Saudi Arabia, of which I was a prominent member. The problem is they couldn't find me because I was sleeping in a sleeping bag with Bedouins up near the Kuwaiti border.
That's really admirable. Probably not too many other journalists were doing that.
No, most were not, because in a war, most journalists don't want to go anywhere near the fighting. That's true in every war I covered. That's a perfectly rational response to war, but you shouldn't be there, because then they just publish or disseminate the propaganda and handouts of they get from the embassy or the military. So, in fact, the pool system in the first Gulf War was actually administered by reporters for that reason. And because I was violating the rules, the other reporters, I think there were four or five of them at the New York Times, wrote a letter to the foreign editor accusing me of destroying the New York Times relationship with the military. And but for R.W. Appel, Johnny Appel, who was there overseeing the coverage and who had been in Vietnam, I would have probably been sent back to New York, but he called a meeting and reminded everyone there that we don't work for the U.S. military.
So you're actually speaking out against the second Iraq war and being eventually expelled from the New York Times. That was just sort of the last straw, I guess, for the New York Times. You were already a troublemaker.
Well, it wasn't the last straw because I had been in Paris covering Al Qaeda and been part of the team that had won the Pulitzer, and so the paper was quite happy to have reports outside the pool system because they were stories that no one else had. A pool system, by nature, means everybody's reporting the same garbage and disseminating exactly the same photos, because a pool system means you send up a reporter, you send a wire service reporter and maybe a newspaper reporter and a photographer and a camera person, and then they document the dog and pony show that's put on for them by the military and bring it back to Dahran, and then all the other reporters have access to that material. But it's Stalin-esque in the sense that it's just from this this material is then disseminated by every single news organization. So the Times was quite happy that I was producing original material. What they didn't like is when I publicly began to speak about or criticize Bush's call to invade Iraq. Now, that wasn't an opinion. It was based on, again, 7 years in the Middle East and months of my life in Iraq, the fact that I speak Arabic. I mean, I think most Arabists understood the debacle this was about to become, but it was also just a career killer, especially given the mood of the country in the after 9/11. So that's what I was in the good graces of the New York Times until then.
Mm-hmm. So I've been having a lot of guests, including Medea Benjamin last week, talking about her new book, The War in Ukraine, and I've had a number of guests talking about that. And of course, with Zelensky in D.C. as we speak, we'll have to turn to that as well. But I kind of want to ask you, so you're very, very brutally critical of this people who now it's the, you know, the permanent war with the war on terror. Of course, you could argue that our kind of society, expansionist, capitalist, imperial society, is fundamentally based on permanent war. But it's become, the war on terror sort of makes it a all-encompassing rubric to make it easy to do that. But so you're very critical of the people who can continue that, including you talk about the Kaplans. I'd like you to talk about them and Victoria Nuland, who's married to one of the Kaplans. But you're saying that you're this deep experience you had, which you share with other people who really learned the lesson and didn't fall into the boosterism, veterans and other war correspondents, who as a compared to some of these neocons and some of these boosters who haven't really been at war and never really learned these lessons that we seem to repeat over and over again, the same mistakes. And you're saying that the reality that you experienced, and not just that, you saw the way that policy played out over and over again. Talk a little bit about some of those lessons you learned, and talk about some of the people who continue to perpetuate this over and over again.
Well, this is the chapter called The Pimps of War, and I've been dealing with them since Central America. Elliot Abrams and Robert Kagan were in the State Department when I was covering the war in El Salvador and the Contras in Nicaragua, and their job was really to attempt to discredit everything that reporters on the ground were reporting. It doesn't matter how wrong they are. They are funded by the war industry. Their think tanks are funded by the war industry. Project for the New American Century, American Enterprise Institute, Foreign Policy Initiative, Institute for the Study of War, Atlantic Council, and Brookings Institution. And they were behind the fiascos of the Middle East, lobbying for them for war with Iraq. They were behind the expansion of NATO up to Russia's borders, despite the warnings by Sovietologists like George Kennan and others that this was baiting and provoking Russia. They are the cheerleaders for the war in Ukraine. This, and what's the goal? I mean, as far as I can see, it's just the utter destruction of Ukraine. I mean, it's a very cynical policy. It has nothing to do with Ukraine. It has to do with degrading the Russian military and weakening and perhaps ousting, if possible, Vladimir Putin with Ukrainian blood. There'll be nothing left, very little left of Ukraine by the time they're done. And they keep all of their perches on the cable news channels and everything because they are puppets of the war industry, which is cannot be crossed. Cannot be, neither party will cross them or challenge them. And this is Arnold Toynbee writes about this as being one of the primary symptoms of the decay or death of any empire when you have this rapacious, unchecked, unregulated military. I studied classics at Harvard. It was much the same with ancient Rome, where in the end the Praetorian Guard was auctioning off the seat of the emperor to the highest bidder. And so these people have caused tremendous human suffering, overseen and lobbied for the rapacious kind of needs of the war industry that are hollowing the country out from the inside. $850 billion defense budget, and they're the same people. They never go away. I mean, Victoria Nuland, who now works for Biden, used to work for Vice President Dick Cheney. I mean, they're kind of protean. They slip from one Republican or Democratic administration. Doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I almost wanted to ask you to actually read some from that. That's a really powerful chapter. That they're all powerful, that the pimps of war. I don't know. I just want to read a couple sentences, just to give people the flavors. Sorry to steal your thunder here. The state cabal of warmongering pundits, foreign policy specialists, and government officials year after year decide debacle after debacle, smugly dodge responsibility for the military fiascos they orchestrate. They are protean, shifting adroitly with the political winds, moving from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party and then back again, mutating from cold warriors to neocons to liberal interventionists. Pseudo-intellectuals, they exude a cloying Ivy League snobbery as they sell perpetual fear, perpetual war, and a racist worldview where the lesser breeds of the earth only understand violence. Wow. So we got to take a little break here. There's a lot to cover. We want to definitely go into Zelensky's visit. I'm going to have you do some more readings. But we are in our end of the year membership drive. And that means we are asking you who are listening to this right now, live, or even if you're listening afterwards, you can still go to kbo.fm/give and or click on donate in your mobile app, or you can text KBOO to 44321, or you can send a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. And Chris and his publisher, OR Books, no, I'm sorry, what's your publisher?
Seven Stories Press.
Seven Stories, that was Medea Benjamin, sorry. So many books. Seven Stories Press are kindly offering some copies of this book for a minimum $60 donation. The Greatest Evil is War. And so, yeah, those are some reasons. I was going to say that last time you were on, may have been a membership drive as well, but you were actually had been deplatformed, I think it was from YouTube. that was the supposed deplatforming everybody having to do with Russia, because you had been on Russia Today, and we can invite people to go back to that show. We can talk to you a little bit about that. But you were had even more reason to celebrate places like KBOO and community radio and small cable outlets and other and internet sites and whatever, because you no longer had that platform of Russia Today, where you actually had, I believe, criticized the invasion of the Ukraine by Russia. But maybe just give us a few sentences on that and any updates on that situation.
Sure, RT was shut down. I mean, you know, the problem is they create a media landscape where voices like mine are marginalized and have very few outlets. So I did have a show for 6 years on RT, and then they'll demonize the outlets you're on. The show was not, none of my shows were on Russia. They were the same shows that I had previously on Telesur, and Telesur had crashed and burned when Argentina and other countries went right wing and stopped funding it. So it was just rebranded with another name. And it was a show that focused on American empire and capitalism. And I did a lot of stuff on our relationship with Israel, having spent a lot of time in Israel and being a strong supporter of the BDS movement. So when they shut RT down, my entire archives of my shows on YouTube were erased. They disappeared. Somebody has put them back up on the Chris Hedges YouTube channel, so they're now there. But the intent was really to block out the voices that I had lifted up, and that's not conjecture. I did a lot on the prison system in the United States. I teach through Rutgers University in the New Jersey prison system. In fact, I just finished my last class for this semester last night. But from the 2017 Director of National Intelligence report, 7 pages of that are dedicated to RT, and they attack RT not for disseminating Russian propaganda specifically, but for giving, these are their words, voices to Black Lives Matter activists, third-party candidates, anti-fracking activists, anti-imperialists, and that's what they... especially as the ruling elites, both Republican and Democrat, lose tremendous amounts of credibility, and they, I think, have gone fiercely after critics such as myself. And again, when I was with Truthdig, before we went on strike and got fired, when the publisher tried to get rid of Bob Scheer, the editor-in-chief of Truthdig. But before that, the IT people ran an analysis of what they call impressions. So that's where somebody went to Google and typed in imperialism, then any article that had been written recently on that topic, including mine, would come up, and then that mine don't come up through the algorithm. So referrals by impressions had dropped over a 12-month period from over 700,000 to well below 200,000, and they probably perfected the system, so it's even lower than that. So our voices have been clearly targeted, which is why independent media such as KBOO, Sheer Post, Bob Sheer started his own site. I'm now like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald on Substack, which is chrishedges.substack.com, and then have a show on The Real News, which again doesn't take corporate money. That's vital for the freedom of the press and for challenging a narrative that at this point, whether it's the New York Times or MSNBC, is really written by corporations.
There's a certain irony, I guess a logic almost, that some of the most strident anti-imperialist voices like yours ended up on RT and are routinely excluded. It becomes, you know, the catchword is normalized, that it just seems seamless. You just flip through the cable channels, and you just don't hear. I mean, where are the voices, critical voices on this Ukraine war? It's unanimous almost. It's truly, yeah. It's really astounding. So I want
to. That was also true with Iraq. I mean, so Phil Donahue, who was against the war, although he had the highest rated show, most watched show on MSNBC, was kicked off the platform. So was Jesse Ventura. They'd signed a contract with him, I think, for $3 million. And because he came out against the war, they never even launched a show.
So I want to edge back into the war in Ukraine issue, and you know, on the occasion of Zelensky's visit to D.C., which you can talk about, in the request for another $1.8 billion on top of, I think it was the same figure before. But a listener called in actually during Medea Benjamin's interview last week and made a point that I didn't really catch on up on as much as I should. He brought up the distinction between worthy and unworthy victims, which you have a chapter on that. And I had no clue that actually comes from Chomsky and Herman's book, Manufacturing Consent. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and that's a great book that they did on the press. Matt Taibbi's book, Hate, Inc., is also good because the media landscape has changed since Chomsky wrote the book, but they're both great books. And they make that distinction correctly. So we are outraged at what's happening to the Ukrainians, as we should be. I mean, I'm not in any way mitigating the horror and the suffering that they're enduring. But we ignore the suffering of the Palestinians or the Yemenis because they're unworthy victims. I saw that when I covered the war in El Salvador. In 1984, there was a Polish priest who was murdered by the communist regime in Poland, and the Reagan administration couldn't stop speaking about it, whereas in El Salvador, we had the Archbishop Oscar Romero assassinated by the government while he was saying mass. We had four American church women who were brutally raped and murdered by the Salvador National Guard, and they made excuses for the murder. Alexander Haig said, well, they probably ran a roadblock, and Jean Kirkpatrick, who was the UN ambassador, said they were more than nuns, kind of stuff. And so that gets, even if you're American, you can be an unworthy victim. So that distinction is important, and we will hold up certain victims, like Ukrainian victims, and ignore other victims that suffer just as egregiously, like Palestinians.
And so, yeah, talk about Zelensky's. We can't let that pass unobserved that he is in D.C. right now.
Well, I was in Eastern Europe in 1989. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. I was acutely aware, as a reporter, of the overtures of Mikhail Gorbachev to create a security and economic partnership with Europe and the United States. The promises that have been made to Gorbachev not to expand NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany, by Hans Dietrich Genscher, the German foreign minister, James Baker, Secretary of State, Margaret Thatcher. But all of those promises were violated, and they were, I think, violated for two reasons. One, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States began to speak about what they called, or the leaders of the United States began to speak about what they called a unipolar world, which meant complete, total, absolute U.S. hegemony. And then you had the arms manufacturers who realized that expanding NATO meant billions upon billions in profits. And I think those were the two driving forces. Despite repeated protests from Moscow, despite an understanding by people who knew the Soviet Union that this was a provocation that could end in a confrontation, the ambassador to Moscow, now the head of the CIA, Burns, with the WikiLeaks, wrote a memo talking about the danger of arming Ukraine or proposing NATO membership to Ukraine. Everybody knew. There's a chapter in the book called Chronicle of a War Foretold. So it wasn't a surprise, but now We are flirting with a direct confrontation with Russia. We are provoking a nuclear power. We're about to send Patriot missiles. There's no, like the Middle East, that nobody has yet explained what the end of this conflict looks like. I mean, the New York Times ran an editorial a couple months ago, which correctly said this call for recapturing all of Ukraine, including areas where ethnic Russians have been living for two centuries, is not realistic. And I think the goals are very cynical. It's about degrading the Russian military and attempting to overthrow Putin. That's it. And it has very little to do with Ukraine, I mean, Ukraine itself.
And I just want to once again remind people that we are in our end of the year membership drive. I guess first I should remind people that this is Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm your host, Paul Roland. Be with you for another almost half an hour, 25 minutes. And our guest today, we are so happy to have Chris Hedges, and he is talking about his powerful new book, The Greatest Evil is War. And I want to kind of get back into some readings in a bit here, but I did want to again give you the way, if you haven't heard it before especially, or maybe you forgot it, but our website is kbo.fm. Right there on the homepage, it's a big donate button on the upper right-hand corner. Or just go to the shortcut, kbo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. With these technologies expanding, we have all sorts of different ways of getting through to us. You can send a check the old-fashioned way to KBO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And as we've been saying, as Chris has been reinforcing the voices like his, there's ever dwindling seemingly, well, there's ever expanding platforms in a sense because of the internet. But you know, the cable TV news, and I guess we could even give a nod to right-wing AM radio, which is an incredibly dominant force that still kind of a sleeper cultural force that people don't really realize how many people actually get their news and opinions through. And since the demise of Air America, we could even talk about that, there really is no national, well, there's NPR, of course, sorry about that. And of course, you're not going to find Chris Hedges on NPR either. Anyway, just a long way of saying that KBU Community Radio is just an absolutely vital place, resource to get this kind of news and information. And you just won't find Chris. I don't know if you'll find him anywhere else on the airwaves here in Portland. So this is your opportunity to express your appreciation for us, for our 54 years of existence, for persevering, for thriving, for bringing you all this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And again, you can express that appreciation, become a new member if you aren't already. Less than 10% of people who listen to KBU aren't members. That's all right. We love people who listen, but we'd like to up that percentage just a little bit if we could. So text KBU to 44321. Go to our website, kboo.fm. We really appreciate it. And this is a call-in show, and it looks like we have a caller. The number to call in is 503-231-8187. I know I'm giving out a lot of data, a lot of numbers and info. 503-231-8187 to be able to speak to Chris Hedges. Norm, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Paul. Thank you. I love your show, always. Mr. Hedges, if you had President Biden in a room by yourself, what the hell would you tell him about that stupid escapade in the Ukraine that we seem to be sinking billions of dollars into? What would you say?
I don't think that a figure like Biden, who of course has very limited intelligence, probably declining intelligence, would hear it. You know, he was anointed by the establishment of the Democratic Party because his entire political career has been subservient to the military-industrial complex, neoliberalism. I look at my students. He and Clinton doubled the size of the prison population. Biden was behind not only the three strikes you're outlaws, but also militarizing police. So, you know, his entire political life has been defined by total subservience to these forces. So. I think at that point, you know, they don't hear it. They don't hear it. They're not interested. Oh. They don't hear it. And
well, I've enjoyed listening to you, as usual.
Okay. Well,
and I wish you luck with your books and with your further journeys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in, Norm. And you too can call in. We have limited ability to call in because, again, we are on our membership drive, and we only have Chris Hedges on rarely. But you mentioned Biden. One thing I didn't follow up on with Medea in her book is she alludes to a role that Biden played in the events of 2014 in Ukraine, where Victoria Nuland was so prominent. Do you have any knowledge on that?
No, not beyond what was reported. That you're talking about the 2014 overthrow of the Ukrainian government that had good relations with Russia. We don't know. I think the assumption is that there was heavy involvement in that by the CIA and other forces. We have, of course, the leaked phone tape of her speaking to the U.S. ambassador, where she talks about putting into power groups or people that will be hostile to Moscow, all of which did receive power. And I think the interesting thing about Zelensky, and then of course it ignited this kind of low-level conflict in the Donbass and other regions, which left thousands of dead. I mean, what's interesting about Zelensky is that when he ran as a candidate, he made an issue of the fact that he was a fluent Russian speaker, that he wanted peace, that he, and I think it's pretty clear that these kind of neo-fascist forces made very clear to him, although they're probably not a majority, but remember they have armed militias, that he was to have no relations with Moscow if he wanted to keep the presidency and perhaps even his life, and he very swiftly changed his tune. So there are very dark forces that have reconfigured Ukraine. And after 2014, I think Ukraine, in essence, became a de facto NATO country. Not only did we provide all sorts of arms, but it's estimated we trained 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers. So Russia has every right to feel aggrieved. That doesn't justify in any way the invasion of Ukraine. Preemptive war under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression, as was our war in Iraq. So I have no problem with dragging Putin off to The Hague to face war crime charges, as long as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are in the cells next to him.
And in fact, on that note, on page 25, you have this wonderful part. There's so many things that are really worth reading out loud here. Is on talking about how what it would be like if the U.S. had sanctions against it, analogous to the sanctions imposed on Russia and imposed on so many other countries throughout the last few decades. I guess I'll just point to that because the show's running away a little bit. We did have two more readings we wanted to get to, and we now have two more callers. Let's just go to our next caller, and then we'll get to that. Because I want to get back to the really essence of this book, whose name is The Greatest Evil is War, which is, really about the nature of war, the experience of war. And then from there, it kind of goes out into, you know, the continuing causes for war and the whole permanent war economy and such. But let's just hear what Greg has to say. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that, you know, we're going to have this offensive going on in southern Ukraine. So I'm glad you brought, Chris, I'm glad you brought up the phone call with Victoria Nuland, who I believe is still running the country. By the way, Zelensky has absolutely no power. You understand that? There is no power behind him. They just allowed him to be elected because of the massive corruption that we had after we overthrew the country in 2014. There's no Zelensky negotiating with the Russians. We have to negotiate with the Russians, obviously. So Putin is not going to allow his naval base, Sevastopol, to be threatened. So since our side will not cooperate, and that would be us, we run NATO, of course, he has said he's going to destroy Odessa. He's got to protect Sevastopol.
Okay, we don't have a whole lot of time. Let's just let
you raise a good point, because it by giving up that naval base, it becomes a NATO naval base.
He's not going to give up the naval base, Chris. You understand that?
I'm saying that is a very legitimate concern on the part of the Russian government. They do not want that to become a NATO naval base,
Okay, Greg, we've got to move on. Sorry, we have another caller, and we have a lot to get to. Thanks for calling. Go ahead, Chris. Chris?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, I just said we're just kind of running out of time. I just wanted to, because I'm Greg has made that same point about three times in the past few weeks. That's, and maybe people haven't heard it, but. I've heard it a lot, and so go ahead.
Yeah, no, I don't have anything more to say. I mean, I think that is a major concern on the part of Russians, and has been since the inception of this conflict, going back to 2014.
Okay, let's hold off Robbie, our next caller. I just want to, so you did want to read from Chapter 7, Existential Crisis. Would you like to lay that on us?
Sure. The crisis faced by combat veterans returning from war is not simply a struggle with trauma and alienation. It is often for those who can slice through the suffering to self-awareness, an existential crisis. War exposes the lies we tell ourselves about ourselves. It rips open the hypocrisy of our religious and secular institutions. Those who return from war have learned something which is often incomprehensible to those who have stayed home. We are not a virtuous nation. God and fate have not blessed us above others. Victory is not assured. War is neither glorious nor noble. And we carry within us the capacity for evil we ascribe to those we fight. The words these prophets speak are painful. We, as a nation, prefer to listen to those who speak from the patriotic script. We prefer to hear ourselves exalted. If veterans speak of terrible wounds, visible and invisible, of lies told to make them kill, of evil committed in our name, we fill our ears with wax. Not our boys, we say, not them, bred in our homes, endowed with goodness and decency. For if it is easy for them to murder, what about us? And so it is simpler and more comfortable not to hear.
And that gets back to what we started out with in talking about your own personal experiences with war as a journalist. So maybe you didn't get the, you know, you were less exposed. You were exposed, but less exposed to the direct mortal threat of weaponry.
Well, no, I wouldn't say less. I mean, okay. You're in Sarajevo. That's pretty indiscriminate. We were 4 to 5 dead a day. 2 dozen wounded a day, 45 foreign reporters had been killed before I got there.
Fair enough.
No, we're it's not less.
Okay. But you were talking about the experience and the difficulty of imparting the experience of war. I mean, you can describe it, but, you know, those words, you know, they're easy to hear, but to really sink in and really resonate, you have to have been there, experienced it. And people just don't want to go there. It's too horrible.
Yeah.
And
for many reasons.
For many reasons. So we can get more into that. And again, Chris Hedges, The Greatest Evil is War. We are offering it for a $60 or more membership offer, pledge.
And we should include there, Paul, that the publisher has arranged for me to sign the copy. So if you order the $60, they're going to ship it to me with the name, and I will ship it to KABU, and everybody will get a signed copy, personalized signed copy.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And we have a couple more callers. Robbie, please be less than a minute because we're really running out of time, and we got another caller after you. Go ahead, Robbie.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. I just wanted to ask a question, actually, with the landscape that the media is in right now. It's a real great breath of fresh air to hear, your shows this week and last week as well. What I wanted to ask you, Chris, and I love your work. It's I'm very grateful to have you, especially at a time like this. But I wanted to bring up two instances, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and then the Poland missile. I don't think people... just watching the Americans react to this and blame Russia for blowing up their own pipeline, and then also the Poland missile strike. We were on the verge of war by CIA intelligence trying to frame that missile was indeed a Russian missile when in fact it was Ukrainian. But how do we, where do we, how can we, you know, do you know any more information about this? It seems like the media is just covering those stories under the rug because clearly it was American intervention.
Okay, thanks, Robbie.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. It doesn't make sense to me from the outside that Russia would blow up its own pipeline, but we don't know. In terms of the missile, that was an AP report that it was a Russian missile when it wasn't, it was supposedly based on a NATO source. We also had CBS do an investigative report that said it was estimated that only 30% of the arms that were being shipped and weaponry that was being shipped to Ukraine were ending up in the hands of the Ukrainian military. The rest was being siphoned off into the black market or into the hands of warlords or fascists or like the Azov Battalion and others. And that was very swiftly repressed. And then we have to add to the fact that the reporting in Ukraine is very heavily controlled. Reporters and photographers, camera people are taken out by Ukrainian minders for a couple hours somewhere near the front line or in a town that has been recaptured and then trotted back to file their reports. So we're not getting the reports we're getting are so sanitized. There have been very credible reports, for instance, of the Ukrainians assassinating or executing people they consider to be Russian collaborators. But we don't get that. I'm not in any way saying that Russia is not doing the same thing. That's the lesson I learned in war, that both sides lie like they breathe. But it's why you need good and independent reporting, and you're right, we're not getting it.
Okay, thank you for calling, Robbie, and our two previous callers. We got one, probably our last caller, Sopatova. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Sopata. Hey, Chris, it's an honor to hear you speak here on our local radio station. And my question was kind of bringing it more home, more homeland. And you've been abroad reporting on this war, and we've kind of been having, it seems like, a war of our own within our country here, over this our last leadership and them being on trial and what that means on a global scale for our country. If you have any thoughts on that.
You're talking about the political divisions within the United States?
Yes, the political divisions within the United States. And how far off are we from ending up like another country that we're seeing out there?
Well, I find many echoes of Yugoslavia, a war that I covered. So the war in Yugoslavia was caused by the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia, and it vomited up these figures like Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman, ethnic nationalists, racists, and they put forth narratives that glorified whatever ethnic group they came from and demonized the other group until there was no possibility of communication between these sides, and eventually, of course, erupting into war. I see the same thing happening here, and the root cause is the economic destruction that was visited on the United States through deindustrialization, austerity, Republican and Democrat, of course. And so people reacted in much the same way. I was in Montgomery, Alabama, with Brian Stevenson, the great civil rights lawyer, and he was walking me through the city, and it's filled with these Confederate memorials. And Brian said they've all been put up in the last 10 years by people who've been stripped of a sense of identity, a sense of place, what the sociologist Emile Durkheim would call social bonds that knit you to the society, and they have retreated into this neo-Confederate myth and white supremacy and everything else. And I said to Brian, it's exactly what happened in Yugoslavia. So Biden, I think in many ways, was our last chance to begin to address the grotesque social inequality and distortions that have caused the rise of these political deformities. The Democrats, not surprisingly, have failed to do this. And I think we're headed for a very rough and dangerous period. I mean, we have flirted now in several occasions with political assassinations, including a couple of years ago that guy who mailed pipe bombs to the leaders of the Democratic Party. If they'd gone off, he would have decapitated. So Pelosi's house was, you know, her husband was attacked. We saw January 6th. So without addressing the underlying primarily economic factors as well as the political stagnation John Ralston Saul calls the corporate coup d'etat in slow motion that we've undergone, without addressing that, then we're headed for pretty serious trouble.
Okay, well, I feel
that 100%. I feel like there's a glooming silence. There's a silence amongst those who have control over that, and I feel the silence is really what's destroying our political.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate you making that point. And to all our callers, we have to leave you now. Can't get to you, Harry. We're just out of time here. We're not going to have time for that last one. I guess there's a point I really wanted to get to, which is that it seems to me that this, you know, the whole one of the big enablers of the war machine, amongst all the ones you talked about, and is this idea that, you know, we do have this progress where, you know, and there is real progress in terms of, you know, some basic bills allowing civil liberties, allowing racial equality. Those are real things, gender equality. But it seems like they're bought at the price of the imperial empire continuing. There seems to be this huge displacement, separation, and people sort of going along with that if they can just get those basic, but it's just not going to continue.
Well, it's not that those things aren't important. They are. But on all the substantial issues, whether it's war, trade deals, wholesale surveillance, austerity programs, the destruction of the working poor and the middle class, there's no daylight between the Republicans and the Democrats. And that is, they're disemboweling, the war industry is just disemboweling the country. It's hollowing the country out from the inside and then bringing back the brutal tools of subjugation used on the outer reaches of empire to the United States: militarized drones, surveillance, terrorism laws that strip you of due process, militarized police that function, especially in urban areas, as internal armies of occupation. And that is, again, if you know anything about empire, I mean, read Thucydides. So Thucydides wrote that the tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. It's nothing new, unfortunately, and we're in that replicating that kind of pattern of late empire, which is destructive and ultimately self-destructive.
That's going to be the last word. Thank you so much again, Chris. And once again, you can get a copy of his new book, The Greatest Evil is War, well worth reading, for a minimum $60 pledge. And you can get a signed copy by Chris Hedges himself by going to kboo.fm and click on donate or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you so much, Chris Hedges.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for doing it.
All right, and we got to go. Thanks, everybody who's contributed and who will contribute. We really appreciate it.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:58 a.m. Next up is Fight the Empire.